This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you wonder why animals do some of the amazing things they do, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls today, we have another special topic to share, Patricia.
We do. You know, most of us know about guide dogs for the blind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hearing dogs for the hearing impaired. But now there is a new kind of assistance dog called a reading education assistance dog.
Hmm.
And a little later in the show, we're going to talk about why these dogs might be better reading companions than other people.
And we'll also examine the relationship between Civil War soldiers and their horses. We'll be talking with a filmmaker about his new documentary, The Horse of Gettysburg. That's all still to come, but for now, we're ready to take some calls, so let's do that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Rachel. I'm in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Rachel, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
You know, people say they're either a dog person or a cat person, and I'm totally a dog person. And my good friend and one-time housemate is really a cat person. And we tried to share a two-bedroom house with her three cats and my one dog. And we had a horrible time, not because my dog chased the cats, but because the cats picked on my dog. Actually went out of their way to stalk him, wake him up if he was sleeping, and antagonize him. I would, if I had him in my bedroom with the door closed, you would see their paws coming under the door trying to bat at him. And so my question is, what is going on with those cats? And I know I've heard calls before about how to get your dog not to chase cats. There's all kinds of ways that you can encourage them to do something else. But how do you get the cats not to pick on the dogs?
And so you really love cats now, right? You're
yeah.
Now you've been seduced.
I tell you what, these cats were mean. I tolerate them, but you know, we could not live together because of her cats and my dog. We had to find other roommates.
Yeah. There are cats who love to get something started. You know, they're individuals, I think, of every species who just like to start stuff, right? I've seen squirrels who will just sit and just egg dogs on, right? But I have known cats, as the cats of your friend, who, whether they wanted to get the dog to play with them, and we'll never know what their motivation was. You know, we can't get into their brain. But there's certainly individual cats out there who have indeed harassed dogs. And I would say of all the dog-cat problems, at least a third of them are the cats are the ones who are initiating the problems. So it's certainly not always in the dog's court.
Right.
So the question I guess you have is what to do about it if it happens again?
Right, yeah. As a matter of fact, my daughter really wants a cat, and I just keep flashing back to those horrible roommate days. And I what would I do if the cat behaves that way?
Yeah, one thing you could try is starting with a kitten. And ideally, you could either start with a kitten from parents that you knew who were very mellow and sort of unreactive, sort of couch cats. Or there's so many cats that need rescuing. You know, I'd love you to go to a shelter or rescue group and get a young cat from there. You might well be able, first of all, to find a cat who needs a home, who's an older cat. It's very common. There are lots of older cats who needs home, who needs homes, who have gotten along historically very well with other dogs, in that they either leave the dog alone or they curl up and sleep with them. So there are lots of cats that aren't like these sort of Dennis the Menaces or the Siamese and Lady and the Tramp.
Exactly.
If you remember them. So a lot of it's about personality. And that's probably the most important thing, is if you want to bring a cat in purposely and voluntarily into your home, you just need to pick the right cat. So that's part of it. Try and find a cat who has a history of being mellow and wonderful around dogs. The other thing that you can also employ is to use some kind of a correction, some kind of a consequence that's going to affect the cat and not the dog. And this gets a little tricky because, say, your cat started to harass the dog. If you, raise your voice, you're going to affect the dog as well. If you threw a paperback book in front of the cat to startle the cat, you might also startle the dog. So this is a little tricky thing. What you might want to try first off is a spray squirt bottle that has a hissy sound to it.
Right.
A lot of people with cats have several of them, one in every room. Because that hissy sound can be very, very useful at getting a cat's attention. And if they learn to associate it with getting a little mist of water sprayed in their face, most cats don't like it. Of course, I guarantee you there are cats out there who are like, oh,
no, that's fine.
A shower, spray me again. So there are always exceptions. But usually that's something that bothers cats but not dogs.
Hmm.
So that's what you might want to try.
Give that a try. And thank you very much for calling, Rachel. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Jason from Pasadena, Maryland.
Jason, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a nom. Well, he's about 9 years old, a cockapoo that is considerably larger than we expected him to be. He's about 37 or 38 pounds.
Whoa, that's pretty big for a cockapoo.
He's very affectionate. He's a great member of the family.
Good.
We love him dearly. But he barks very loudly and now has become more aggressive in his behavior when the telephone rings.
Oh, no kidding.
Not only the house phone, but particularly the house phone, but also if there is one of the cell phones, my wife's or my cell phone, is ringing in the vicinity. Nikki gets nuts, and he's gotten louder and louder and louder, and at times has become aggressive. He's never bitten, aside from, you know, the typical puppy nipping.
Sure.
He has never bitten, never nipped, and I don't want to find another home for him because he's part of the family.
Dog. Well, here's
but
the good news.
I've got a 3.5-year-old grandson that's getting in the way.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I hear you loud and clear. So this is potentially really serious. And as wonderful a dog as you describe, it is possible for the best of dogs when they get that emotionally aroused. You know that great saying, I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out. It happens to dogs, too. They lose emotional control. They get so excited and so aroused that they become aggressive, not even intentionally. So here's the good news is this is the kind of behavior that you can have a lot of control over. So when you're not working on this, you can turn your cell phone on to vibrate. You can turn the ringer on your phone's down. And even when the phone rings, you're home, the dog's there, and you can teach the dog a different response. I would schedule actual training sessions where you're going to have a friend or a member of the family call you.
Use the cell phone.
Use the cell phone. Turn it down. Great thing about cell phones is you can turn it down to very, very low. And so what's going to happen is just ask your friend to let it ring once and then hang up. So it's going to ring once, and as it rings, you're going to call your dog to you, ask for a sit, and then you're going to give him a really, really good treat. And your friend, by arrangement, is going to call 1 minute later. And you're going to do that 6 times in a row. So you just had a little training session. Every time the phone rang, and it just rang once, because if it rang 7 times, he would start getting overly aroused and wouldn't be able to think and learn. You want to keep it quiet and make it easy for him at first. Make it easy for him to win. And then you gradually expand on that. And the big trick here is to understand that the difference between novices and professionals is understanding what expanding means. It doesn't mean going from doing that for 3 days and then expecting him on day 4 to sit when the phone rings completely by surprise and it's turned up and it's rung 15 times and he's barking and he's hysterical and you ask him to sit and he doesn't. You need 6 months in between. So gradually work your way up so that he's sitting when the phone rings longer and longer or the bell gets louder, only change one thing at a time.
But it does take maybe...
It takes some time.
Yeah.
And some management. You need to think this through and manage it such that that behavior you don't want is prevented as much as you can while you're working on it.
And good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Bridget, and I'm calling from Potomac, Maryland.
Bridget, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
My family and I have a 2.5-year-old Catahoula mix, or at least that's what we think she is. And she's had horrible skin allergies since she was 6 months old. So we're on a new program of treatment where we actually have a serum that's composed of her environmental triggers. And we have to inject this serum every 21 days. And it's a fairly large injection, so it's not a quick prick.
Ooh.
Yeah. And she's a very sensitive, incredibly soft little girl, but she's also very dominant.
Okay.
So she's starting to get agitated with us. And her reaction is kind of escalating. And now she's kind of pushing the boundaries to see what she can do to get
you guys
away.
Stop this.
Exactly. Even if it's not hurting her, we have to kind of manhandle her. And like I said, she's so soft that that's detrimental to. It's just not a good.
Gotcha.
It's like traumatizing for everybody.
Gotcha.
Sure.
Gotcha. And so things have gone farther along than one would hope. You know, it's going to be a little harder to sort of back up a little bit. One is, and this is going to sound, I don't want you to think this is harsh, because this is for her benefit, truly. I would condition her to a muzzle, so you can just take that whole concern out of the picture. Because she does have weapons. She can hurt you. And knowing that she's turning around, she's starting to give you a little, like, you know, I'm thinking I've got a mouth here and there's stuff in it. I can use it on you.
Yeah.
That adds to the tension. And so I would... completely out of the pattern, not while you're giving her injections, I would teach her this fun muzzle game.
Ooh,
okay.
It's the muzzle. And I would literally...
Yeah, she knows touch, so just get her to touch it and then acclimate like the head halter.
Yeah, except I wouldn't use a head halter. I'd use a wire basket muzzle.
Yeah.
Those are much more comfortable than the Mickey muzzles are for dogs. So completely out of the pattern of these injections, teach her that like when you say, do you want your muzzle? She comes running.
Okay.
So then when you're going to actually do it, I want you to muzzle her, because it just takes all of this tension out of the process. Another alternative is to take her to the veterinarian, let the veterinarians do it, as long as you're comfortable that their staff is going to be really gentle and really kind. Do it as quickly as possible. And I think, even though normally I'd be talking about counter-conditioning right now, I think it might be beyond that. And I think the tools that I've talked about might be really helpful.
Good luck. Sounds like you've got a long road ahead of you, and I hope things work out, Bridget. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Coming up next, we'll find out about how dogs are helping some children learn to read. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Each week, Patricia and Larry give you great advice that helps you deal with your pet's behavior, but sometimes you want more. Do you want to go in depth into one of the pet topics you've heard on the show? Do you want more advice? More pet fun? Well, why not check out our website? It's callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. You know, most of us know about guide dogs for the blind and hearing dogs for the hearing impaired. But, Tricia, you are here to tell us there's a new kind of assistance dog in town.
That's right. And it's called a Reading Education Assistance Dog, or READ.
Ah, cool. Who are these dogs helping out?
Well, you know, these dogs can help any child, really, learn to enjoy reading even more. But they're especially useful for children who have difficulties with reading.
Yeah.
And so in this program, I love this program, children sit down and they read to the dog instead of reading to a teacher or to the class as a whole.
Why would it be better to read to a dog rather than another person?
Well, because you get to pet them.
Yeah, you can't.
Actually,
pet them.
That's probably an important aspect.
Yeah.
That children are actually usually in physical contact with these dogs, and that touch is really important. But, you know, we all know that performing in front of others can be really stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some children, they have enough trouble with reading as it is, much less having to perform about it. But when you ask them to read to a dog, a lot of that performance anxiety goes away. And so the program is set up such that the child can read to the dog, they can talk to the dog, they can even answer questions asked by the teacher, who's obviously still there, that relate to the dog. For example, she could say something like, Jimmy, Rover's never heard that word before. Can you tell him what that word means?
Oh.
Isn't that sweet?
That's great. Well, what kind of a dog qualifies to be a special reading assistance dog? Can you use any dog, or do they need special training?
They do need special training. The dogs in this program are registered therapy animals. They're screened for their temperament, for health, for their behavior. And, you know, it might seem like the dogs don't have to do very much. You know, basically, they're sort of
kind of sit there and
lying around and get petted. But if you think about it, it's what they can't do that's the challenge.
Ah.
You know, think about how many dogs you could take into a kindergarten room and sit down with a 6-year-old or a 5-year-old and have the dog not jump up, not be silly, not run around with a book in his mouth, you know, not have an accident on the floor. So that's important. But most importantly, these dogs need to be screened so that no matter what happens, we know that dog isn't going to hurt that child. And some of the best dogs are not always safe around children.
Yeah. It sounds like a great program. Sounds endearing.
It is, doesn't it?
Is it necessary?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I was looking into that because it does sound like I want to do this when I retire. I'm really actually planning on doing it. But is it really necessary? Good question. Well, here's what I learned. It's reported that 40% of children right now are reading below their grade level.
Oh,
40% of them. And we know how important reading is, not just to personal satisfaction, to professional development. I mean, people need to know how to read. So given that statistic, it sure sounds like a good idea to me.
To me, too. Where can our listeners go to learn more about reading assistance dogs?
Well, this program was specifically started by a group called the Intermountain Therapy Animals Group. Mm-hmm. And if you just want to go onto our website, we have a link to them. Just go to callingallpets.org, and you could link to this Intermountain Therapy Group and learn more about the READ program.
Cool program. And if you have a question for us, we are ready to take some more calls. Here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Ron in Northern Virginia.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me. My girlfriend, Diane, has a 4-year-old black lab named Sable. She got Sable last year, and Sable is now 4. And for her first 3 years, she lived with a truck driver who did not lead train her. At times, I think Marley when we're working with Sable.
Life in love with the world's worst dog, right?
There you go. And yes, I cried when I read the book.
Oh, so. I did too.
So when I walk Sable, I've had a little bit of training, so I put the control collar above her Adam's apple with a little slack and hold the lead in my left hand, the end in my right. After a few stern commands of heel and then some tugs, she kind of gets the idea, and she'll heel until she sees another dog, very friendly, let me go play. Yeah. Something else catches her eye. Okay, I'm 6'1" and 210, so I don't have too much trouble keeping under control, although it can get a little tiresome.
Mm-hmm.
Diane's 5'1" mm-hmm. and a lot lighter.
Right.
Plus, she likes able to have a good time when she walks,
yeah.
So, you know, give her some freedom. So she lets her go off heel on the winder lead, but then when Sable goes bounding off, kind of takes Diane with her. And Diane kind of thinks that I'm too mean to Sable and talk to her harshly, although she admits that I seem to get results. So Diane said for me to enjoy the conversation and bring me some good tips.
All right. All right. And here's the good news. I've got a really easy solution for you. How wonderful is that?
Oh, that's very good.
And it doesn't even involve a lot of training. And I'm going to introduce it by asking, how do we move around very, very, very large animals who don't want to come with us, like a horse or a bull? Do we put collars around the base of their neck and expect that that's going to allow us to control them? No. I will answer that myself, right? Right? Imagine a 1,200-pound horse that you're trying to take somewhere and he doesn't want to go there. But you have a lasso around the base of his neck. You're not going to have a lot of control. And it turns out that the physics of a standard collar and leash are not very good. And that the training collars or the choke chain collars basically don't give you very much control. The physics are not on your side. But here there are two solutions that work really well. We use these in Dog's Best Friend training classes all the time for probably half of our clients. I'm going to suggest either use a particular kind of harness, not the standard harness that you put on a dog that allows you to them to pull you like a sled, but it's a harness that has the leash attachment on the dog's chest. It's on the front of the dog. And there's special versions of this made now by several different companies. Premier makes one. Soft Touch Concepts makes one. One of the names is an Easy Walker. And basically, you put this harness on the dog. It's very easy. The dogs just don't seem to object to them at all. They basically tend to ignore them. You put the leash on the loop in the front of the dog's chest. So when you pull on the leash, he can't do what he does when a collar is on him, which is just set his shoulders and then push his body into the collar and pull you along with it. He can't do that with this kind of scenario. There's also what's called a head collar, which is like a halter that you put on a horse that gives you an incredible amount of control. So Diane needs some tools. I would either get this harness or the head collar. And then the other thing I want you to keep in mind is that heel is an unnatural behavior for a dog. We expect dogs to walk shoulder to shoulder with us on a walk because that's what we do with our friends. You know, people do that. It's a primate thing. We walk together along shoulder to shoulder, and that's what friends do. It makes no sense to a dog.
And the harness, I think, is great in a way because they don't seem to mind. You have to do a little more training to get that head collar to work.
Some dogs don't like the head collar. Some dogs are just absolutely fine with it. It does give you a little bit more control. But some dogs, they try to paw it off. They don't like it too much. You do have to make sure it fits correctly. But the harness gives you a little less physical control, but it gives you an awful lot. A lot more than you have right now. And dogs don't seem to mind it at all.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Rod. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Christy Kane calling from Ontario, Wisconsin.
Hi, Christy. Thank you for calling.
Okay, my question is, we have two dogs at home, and one dog, her name is Ruby. She's a field-bred spaniel, and we plan on breeding her within the next few months. And we have another cute little guy. His name is Buddy, and he's a terrier mix. And they are just best of friends. And I just am curious how, and Buddy's been neutered, and I'm just curious how we should prepare for when her pups are born, what to expect. Will she be, you know, defensive with him? Will he try to be like the father? Should we keep them separated? Or I just thought you might have some advice on how to plan for that, or if something does happen, how we would want to deal with it.
Great question.
Oh, it's a great question. I'm so glad you asked, because it is very, very important to keep any other dog out of the room where the litter is for at least 3 weeks. It's very, very important. Most dams are, if they're good mothers, they're extremely protective, and they can get very anxious about their babies. And, you know, when they're really, really young, they don't even quite smell like dogs, much less act like dogs. I mean, they look like little tiny furry guinea pigs, you know? So first of all, you don't know what your terrier cross is going to do. You have no idea. I mean, they might be related to as prey. But that's not that common. But it still can happen. It can happen in a microsecond. And most importantly, for the sake of the dam, you want to just give her and her litter space and peace and quiet, and don't let the other dog in. I had, when I was breeding border collies, the non-bred border collie, Pippi Tay, who I just lost not too long ago. Pippi Tay loved puppies. And she would lie outside the door when Lassie had a litter and just and just waited for the day that she got to be the aunt, and she would aunt them. And so that brings up your next question about what kind of behavior can you expect from the other dog. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely highly variable from a dog who takes over and literally wants to be like a foster mom and sits with the puppies and licks off the puppies and cleans them and protects them, starts to teach them to play as they get older, to a dog who's terrified of them. My one-in-a-million dog, Cool Hand Luke, who was probably the noblest creature I've ever known, was terrified of puppies until they were about 10 weeks old. His eyes would get big like round pancakes, and he'd start sucking, and he'd shut his mouth and suck his lips together, and he'd just run away from them. You know, so I just let him. He wouldn't hurt them. He'd just like, I don't know what they are. Let me away from them. And some dogs can be quite aggressive. So what you need to do is you need to go very, very slowly. When they're about three and a half weeks, then you want to make an introduction where you have complete control over the terrier. Don't like be pulling back on a leash to sort of add tension, but I would pick up a puppy in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the mom there if she's seeming very comfortable with you around the puppies. Pick up a little puppy in your hand, have somebody else managing right beside the terrier, and just let the terrier sniff just this little tiny piece of fur that you're
exposing
mm-hmm. with your hands covering everything else, and then just go from there.
Well, that's going to be so hard to keep them separated at 3 weeks.
Oh.
So when I let her out, though, away from the pups, then they can play together,
though. Oh, absolutely.
Though. And then...
Absolutely. She should have her private room. There should be the nursery. And she can come out, and she should come out. She needs, obviously, besides going to the bathroom.
Right.
When they're first born, they basically, the real good moms, they don't want to leave them. You mm-hmm. practically have to beg them to go to the bathroom. But after they start getting active and mobile, they're like, can I have a break now? A little hour break, you know? So, yeah, let them play together,
okay.
But don't let the terrier in with the puppies.
Great question.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. You know, before the days of Humvees and battle tanks, horse-drawn artillery cavalries played a vital role in the United States Army. And coming up next, we'll talk to a filmmaker about these cavalries and his latest Civil War documentary. It's called The Horses of Gettysburg. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Trisha's dog training books. If you need help with a multi-dog household, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Trisha has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444, or visit our website at callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Mark Bussler to the program. Mark is the director, producer, and editor of the documentary film Horses of Gettysburg, and he joins us today to talk about it. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you.
This documentary is about the relationship between horses and riders during the Civil War. Can you describe the relationship between the horses and the soldiers who rode them?
Well, it was personal, and their lives both depended on each other. What we went into in the film was the relationship between Southern soldiers and also Northern soldiers, the differences between them and their horses, for instance, early in the Civil War in 61-62. Southern soldiers actually, especially in the cavalry, entered with their own horses off the farm. So they had a very strong bond. They knew their horses knew them. And this was different with the Northern Army that started the war. Even though they had more resources, they were actually assigned horses to them from a government stockpile.
So the Southern horse riders had an advantage there, especially in the beginning.
Yeah, actually, what happened is they had a major advantage early in the war and won most of the cavalry battles. And in 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg was the big turning point because the Southern forces had suffered a number of casualties at that point. A lot of the horses had been killed off. A lot of the riders had been killed off. And at that point, the Union Army actually started getting the edge, and that bond that we were talking about, because they were assigned government horses, grew stronger throughout the war. The Union cavalry got better. They got better with their horses. They had more men. And that's what we saw in 1863, especially on the East Cavalry Field during the Battle of Gettysburg, when General Custer squared off against Jeb Stuart and his cavalry.
I think it's easy for us now, living in the world that we live in now, to forget how reliant people were on these animals. I mean, these horses were incredibly important to their survival, right?
Well, this is in the days before mechanized infantry, before machines, before cars. And this was the only way they had to get around other than just foot power. And they relied on horses both for transportation, for scouting. They would ride ahead of the army and ride up to the... In fact, we cover this in the film where the scouts would ride to a high position and then run back to their generals and give the report on what they saw. In fact, that's what happened on the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg, when the Union vedette was the one to witness the Confederate Army approaching Gettysburg. But they also used horses for moving artillery, for moving supply wagons, and they used mules as well for artillery and wagons and supplies.
Were there positions open as for horse trainers? Did the armies pay people to train some of these horses?
Well, we go into a bit on the training, on how the Union Army in specific trained their horses, because they had more of the procedure down. And what they would do is they would ride the horses into gunfire that was blanks, so they weren't actually shooting at the horses, but just to get the horses used to the noise, the action of battle. They'd wave flags in front of their heads. They would have soldiers ride the horses and actually shoot pistols off next to their heads, just to do everything they could do to get the horses accustomed to the chaos of battle, because you can imagine a battle with hundreds of thousands of people, horses, just shots and shells flying everywhere is complete mayhem. And they had to have their horses be reliable, be comfortable with their riders, be able to take direction and go where they needed to go and not just get scared and run the other direction.
You know, I think it's almost impossible for the average person, certainly for me, to understand the noise and the mayhem, especially the third day of the battle, for example, when it opened with an hour and 45-minute barrage where literally tons of shot flew from both sides, and the noise and the death and the scrambling, how a horse could even perform in that kind of situation. Was there not, what made a really good horse?
We worked from an actual personal account of that moment that you're talking about, which is the first, the morning of the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg, right before Pickett's charge, when the Confederate artillery just pounded the Union lines. The guy's name was Haskell. I think he was a lieutenant. And he was on his horse right after that and described the aftermath about the horses that were hit by the shot and shells, about the horses that were running wild that had broken loose from the trees and from their handlers. He witnessed, I believe it was a number of mules, a shot landed in between a number of mules with artillery and blew the whole thing up. And he actually went to his horse after this barrage, or I guess it was near the end of the barrage. His horse was still tied to a tree, ignoring it all, eating its oats.
that was a good war horse.
Yeah, his name was Dick. He actually ended up, he was one of the very few, if not the only, Union officer that was mounted throughout Pickett's charge. He was riding back and forth delivering orders from one side to the other on the Union line, and he stayed on his horse the whole way through the battle. He had a higher vantage point being up on his horse, and if you've ever been to Pickett's charge, if you're up on that, it's a slight ridge there.
Slight ridge, yes.
Yeah, if you're on a horse, you get a much better vantage point of everything, especially with the 12,000 Confederate soldiers charging towards you. And at the end of the battle, he did end up, he survived, his horse survived, although it was shot several times. And it's a very moving letter.
And so that was one of the real benefits of a horse, to what it brings to the battlefield. What other benefits does a horse bring to the battlefield?
Well, they used horses in a variety of ways. One of the stories we cover in the film is this tremendous ride that a man named Postles did. And what he had to do was deliver a message to a farmhouse that was actually in the middle of that Pickett's charge area. This is before all the Pickett's charge took place. And they didn't have radio and communication like we do now. And this is actually even a problem in World War One. We've done some World War One film as well, and they relied heavily on their animals for communication. So Postles had to ride out to this farmhouse under heavy Confederate gunfire, delivered his order, and then took the message back to General Hancock on the Union line. And it talks about how he rode out there under fire, used his horse as a shield, actually leaned over the side of it like you might see in some of those Westerns, and you got some nice footage of just the horse charging and what this might have looked like and the sound and chaos surrounding him. So that was one use of a horse, was communication, being that they're much faster than a man could run.
And a shield.
Yeah.
And, well, that was, it's sort of tough to hear that because, you know, you don't want the horses to get hit, but the fact is they did use them for pretty much everything they could use them for. They really did abuse their horses, but they also loved them too, but it was a life or death situation for both the man and the horse at the time.
Were there any drawbacks to using horses on the field?
Well, the drawbacks are that it is a living thing. And they, unlike a truck, which might just get blown up and, you know, whatever, the horses were, they got close to them. In fact, we have a number of letters in the film where they do talk about the courage and the sacrifice and bravery of their horses. And when they lost a good horse, they lost that connection with that one animal. And unlike a truck where you might just get issued another truck or a car, you weren't issued exactly the same horse. And that was a negative. What struck me as being interesting was riding these horses also caused a problem with these 13 Confederate officers that rode their horses into this foot charge along with the soldiers. The difficulties were that they were typically moving faster than the men, so they had to continuously hold the horse back a little bit. They were much higher than the average foot soldier, and this made them great targets for the Union side that was shooting at them, because they wanted to, an officer was a prize. They wanted to knock these officers off their horses and shoot the horses, because a downed horse then would cause problems with people running into it and whatnot and flailing about the field. So they would aim at the horses, and of course that was certainly a position I don't know that I'd want to be in the middle of this field of men being up above them all, because it's obvious that that's an officer at that point.
We haven't talked about mules, and I do want to ask you about mules. They had a hand in helping soldiers on the battlefield. In what ways were mules more useful to soldiers than horses?
Well, the mules were very interesting because, and I actually didn't even think of this when I went into filming, because I worked with a mule. I wasn't very familiar with mules. The term stubborn as a mule, which I found firsthand, is true. The mules are very stubborn. They're harder to control than the horses, but they're also much, much stronger and more resilient than the horses. And we go into a number of accounts of how mules were used to pull ammunition wagons. They could generally pull more weight. They would one of the drawbacks was they could not bring them to the front lines, because the mules got very skittish under gunfire and cannon fire, whereas the horses were not known for that.
This film, The Horses of Gettysburg, is part of a larger documentary series. Tell us more about the Civil War series you're working on.
Well, for the past couple of years, I've been producing and directing a series called Civil War Minutes, and Horses of Gettysburg is the fourth documentary in this series. And we had been doing stories for years on soldiers in the battles and just artifacts and how the soldiers lived, their letters home, what they thought about the war personally, how they missed their families. And it's been a really neat series and just very, very personal and coming from their own words. And it kind of occurred to me that we hadn't touched on the horses in the battle and in the Civil War very much. We'd done all this work on people, but what about the horses? Because they obviously were very important in the war. Every picture has a horse in it, practically. All these monuments, or not all of them, but a great number of the monuments have horses, the monuments to cavalry and artillery, and these great equestrian statues that we feature in the film. So we started looking into stories of the horses, and it turned out that it wasn't just interesting, it was actually essential.
As a horse lover, I want to thank you for making this, because even though it's hard to hear about horses being involved in war, it's still, I think it's important for us to remember. We all want to remember the soldiers, the people who sacrificed, and I think it's important to acknowledge and remember the horses that were involved, whether voluntarily or not. So thank you for making it.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark, appreciate it very much. Thank you so much. Mark Busler is the director, producer, and editor of Horses of Gettysburg. He joined us today from the studios of WQED in Pittsburgh. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win a DVD copy of Mark's documentary. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do you have a question for Patricia? I know. Just call the 1-800 number, right? But you're shy, and the idea of talking on the radio gives you hives. So how do you get your question on Calling All Pets? We have a solution. It's called email. Send your pet behavior questions to pets@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and one winner will be selected at random to win a copy of Horses of Gettysburg, directed by Mark Busler. And here's today's question. General Robert E. Lee owned about 5 horses throughout the course of the Civil War, but only one earned Lee's greatest admiration. General Lee's most famous horse was purchased for $200 and proved to be great for an officer in battle because he was difficult to frighten. And after the Civil War, admirers would pluck the hair from his tail as a souvenir of the famous horse and his general. What was the name of General Lee's famed horse? Again, I know the answer to that. If you think you know the answer.
You can't win, Larry.
I know. Call us if you know the answer at 1-800-462-7413. And check out our website in about a week to find out the answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And for now, we are ready to take some more calls. And let's do that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Philip from Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Hi, Philip. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, we have a new cat in our household. She was a stray, but our concern, she's real friendly. We have three dogs, and dogs are getting along okay with her. There's been no problems with that. Now, if she's sitting, like, on a bed, you can go up and pet her. There's no problem. But if you're walking down the hallway and she's in the hallway, she'll get, like, a startled look on her face and take off.
Oh,
you know? And if you squat down, she's more likely to come to you. But just trying to find things to do so she doesn't feel threatened.
Sure, I can understand that.
Yeah, and there are some things you could do. And good for you, for one, just knowing that height is such a big trigger. You know, really, if you put yourself in their perspective and get your head about 7 inches above the ground and then watch a human walking at you, it's pretty impressive.
Right.
Pretty imposing. So keep doing that. That's a great idea. But there are a couple things you could add on. One is you could try just a standard classical conditioning routine where you are loaded with something she loves. And if she loves food, hopefully she's one of those kitties who loves turkey or something, or chicken, or, you know, who knows what it is. Maybe it's squash. You know, they all get to decide what they love the best. And you're going to have a bunch of little pieces of it in your hand. And what you want to do is create a situation where you can walk forward just one step and then throw the food, not at her. I've seen people scare animals that way. You know, try and throw it to the side such that she's not afraid of this flying object coming at her, but also lands close enough to her that her little nose gets in gear and she goes, oh, what's this? But so the scenario is that you walked forward one step and then you stopped and then you threw this little piece of food. So what she's going to learn is a movement toward me leads to something I love. And,
right.
And then you gradually increase the movement towards her. So it's going to be two steps towards her and then throw food, and then three steps and then throw food. And what you can do in certain situations, depending on the logistics, is you can throw food as you're approaching her. If it's a big enough area that you can walk by her.
Yes. Well, sometimes in the hallway it's a little narrower. But
right.
In the living room there's more room.
In the hallway, what you can do is stop and throw food towards her and then throw it a little closer to you. You turn your body slightly away from her and then see if you can throw it eventually beside you and then behind you. So she goes past you and then you can keep walking forward.
Oh.
If you're in a bigger room and you have room to walk beside her with a good distance away from her, then throw the food as you're getting closer. And then as soon as you get level to her and you're going to start walking away from her, say, oh, too bad. No more food. It only comes when I'm coming towards you.
I used your food advice several years ago for one of our dogs that would chase cars, and I made sure as soon as I saw a car, I called her. And so now when I go for a walk, as soon as she sees a car, she comes running.
That's great.
That's great.
So I was trying to do this with the food with the cat, but it wasn't quite working. So, you know, you've modified it in terms of throwing the food so that I can take this new approach.
And the step-by-step part of this is the important part, is that what works is in the details in this particular plan. And good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. You know, a few weeks ago, we responded to an email from some cross-country bicyclists who wanted to know how to fend off aggressive dogs that chase them. Remember that? Along with what Philip was just talking about here. We heard from Brian in Green Bay, Wisconsin, who has a follow-up question, and he says this. I heard Tricia's suggestion to use cut-up treats and toss them at the side of the road to distract the chasing dogs. By doing this, aren't you rewarding the dogs for chasing the bicycle? And won't the next bicyclist have a harder time trying to get rid of the dogs, especially if the biker doesn't have a treat to give? please clarify your advice.
It's a great question. It's a very understandable question. And the answer, believe it or not, is no. If the dog had never chased bicycles before, then you would be teaching this dog to start to chase bicycles. But basically what you're doing is you're teaching this dog that the dogs are chasing the bicycles, one, because they love to run, but mostly because you are seen as a territorial intruder, right? This monstery thing comes dashing into the territory, no greeting ritual, no polite behavior, just rudely imposing. The best analogy I can make is if somebody that you didn't know walked into your house, just walked in. And just started walking towards you really fast. And so dogs are like, who are you? What's going on? and they bark, and what happens? The bike goes, right? It
sure.
Worked. This was an intruder. He shouldn't have been here. I barked and he left. So when you have dogs who already have this behavior, they're bicycle chasers, and they see the bicyclist as a territorial intruder, what the throwing the food does is it changes their emotional reaction. That's what classical conditioning is about. It's changing the emotional reaction. So it's treating the cause rather than just the symptoms.
Okay.
And so what you want is a dog who, rather than seeing this bicycle coming, is like, oh, here it comes again. It's the monster bicycle. It's like, oh boy, here he comes. Now, it's true that they may run out to the edge of their yard. But in most cases, they're going to run out to the edge of the yard and wait for the food to fall, you know? So be sure and try, if you can. I mean, obviously, this is not always possible, but throw it not on the street. I don't want the dog running in the street. Throw it off the street, onto the yard, on the dog's side of the street. And so they might run out to the edge of the lawn, but then they'll stop and they'll wait for the food.
All right. Well, Brian has another suggestion for dealing with dogs on the road.
Okay.
What do you think of this? He carries a compressed air horn in the water bottle holder on his bike, and a short blast of the horn stops the dog in its tracks and can help when motor vehicle drivers aren't paying attention too.
That, you know, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. That's a fine idea. I'm really sound sensitive, so the sound to me would be as aversive as it was to the dog. But there are dogs who are stopped by those air horns. When you're on a bike, you might want to communicate with some people in cars too.
Okay.
So thanks for writing. That was great.
And how do people get a hold of us?
Oh, it's easy. Just send us an email. Send it to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to talk to us over the phone, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413, and let's take another caller. Hi, you're at Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Bradley with Edmond, Oklahoma, and I'm calling because I've never had a dog before, and my wife, in her own polite way, has been after me to get one. We've got two young children, a 15-month-old and a 3-year-old, and I don't know whether it's best to wait until they're older to get a dog. I don't want to be unfair to the animal, obviously. Or there's also the debate as to whether it would be better to get a puppy that would grow up with the children and be used to them, or an older dog.
Right.
The conversation's been on larger dogs, lab or bigger.
Okay. Well, here's good questions, and good for you for asking now. A couple of thoughts. Obviously, no, there's no right that works for everybody. So it's such a individual kind of process. But here's some considerations that you might want to think about. If you have a 15-month-year-old child and a 3-year-old child, raising a puppy in that, man, wow, that's a lot to do. I'll tell you, I've been raising a puppy who's about 10 months old now, and it's a major effort. So it's fun and it's wonderful, but there are advantages to having that little pup grow up with your kids, but it's an awful lot of energy and time, and it adds a level of chaos that sort of doubles the chaos. It's Larry, who has a young child, is like nodding his head. So you might want to think about either getting an older dog who has a history of being great with kids. Now, you need to be very careful, though, and specific, because a lot of people will say, he's fine with kids, or he's great with strangers. And it turns out the specifics of that are he's great with strangers unless, they pet him, in which case he bites their face. So you need to be very specific. And the specific question I always suggest people ask, because it gets right down to it, is if your dog was chewing on a real bone, not a fake bone that you bought at a pet store, but a real bone with meat on it, and a 3-year-old child went to take it away, what would the dog do? And the answer needs to be, oh, he'd lick her face. Now, that doesn't actually fit with a lot of dogs. There are a lot of dogs you would never, ever, ever even put in that situation. But there are plenty of older dogs out there who are mellow and sweet and loving, who really do need older homes. Maybe their owner got too old to take care of them or something. So if you're going to get a dog now, I would consider an older one, as long as it's been temperament tested and you know its history. If you're going to get a younger dog, I would seriously consider waiting. I would just wait until you give yourself a couple more years, until the kids are a little older, and then get your young dog. You know, it doesn't even have to be 8 weeks. Maybe, you know, a well-socialized dog maybe comes in when it's mostly house-trained at 4 months or so. But perhaps it's had a lot of exposure to kids. It was raised in a home, good home breeder who has children herself or himself. And so you already know the dog's been exposed to kids, but doesn't come at 6.5 weeks unable to control its bladder for more than 5 minutes. So those are the things I'd think about when you're tossing this around.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it very much.
Good luck.
Patricia, another great week.
Another day, another dollar? No, that's not the right analogy. Well, it sure was fun anyway.
Sure was a lot of fun. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. And Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and we hope you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0421P and bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with training a new puppy or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or visit our website at callingallpets.org.